Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 19. Oh, it's all good. No worries. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992. Here from our perch in 2023, I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
And your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, a single heterosexual.
So, guys, they're back.
What?
Brooke and Jordan, back from the queer quadrant. To talk with us about maybe the most heterosexual film of 1992.
Perhaps.
We're talking Damage today. I reached out to you guys and I was like, hey, do you want to come on for Damage? And they were like, Brooke and Jordan were like, what's Damage? I was like, don't worry about it. You're going to like it. It's going to be weird. It's a weird movie. Emily, had you seen this previously?
Oh, God, no. No. No, I you know, on the long list of movies from 1992 I was allowed to see, this was not on it, weirdly. And I genuinely, when I looked this up, I was like, I don't think I've heard of this, despite the fact that obviously, like, it got an Oscar nomination. Mm-hmm. It's directed by a big name director. Yeah. Like, the screenwriter is a big name screenwriter. But yeah, I think this movie has been, I will talk about this in a bit, but I was reading Louis Malle's filmography, and he exclusively makes instant classics that set the standard for the form to come.
And Damage.
Deeply horny movies.
Yes.
And movies nobody remembers exist.
Yep.
Yes.
Those are his three lanes, and he overlaps sometimes.
Sure.
And Damage is like a horny movie nobody remembers.
This was
not wrong.
You know, it's interesting because, like, and I don't think this movie has much of a legacy. I think you kind of just outlined it, Emily. It has an Oscar nomination for Miranda Richardson, mm-hmm. Who up until like the last 15 minutes, I was like, why did she get an Oscar nomination for this movie? And then she has like a big breakdown in the kitchen. You're like, okay, I guess, sure.
Well, see, here's the thing. She's a woman over 30 and she shows her tits. So that means that she was brave.
I did actually kind of love that. I was like,
it is a wonderful scene. And yeah. Like, to be clear, I think the last 20-ish minutes of this movie are pretty great.
Yeah.
And everything leading up to them is deeply strange.
Yeah.
It's quite a strange movie. For not that strange, obviously it's a little bit of a fucked up premise, but the premise is not that crazy.
Brooke, what do you mean? Are you saying that it's a little weird to try to fuck your son's fiance?
Who among us hasn't thought about it?
I mean, what's interesting about this movie is I remember this movie coming out because I am.
Did you see it in theaters?
I did not see it in theaters, like but I did see it on video cassette. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't say that in a pervy way, but I remember this movie. I was 12 when this movie came out, and I remember there was a bit of controversy around it because at the time, you know, NC-17 was like the thing, right? Was this was a movie going to get the scarlet letter of NC-17, essentially?
Right.
And this movie did temporarily have that rating until they cut it down a little bit in order to get an R rating. I this is just one of those films that like can be clumped in with and gets clumped in with so many of those like erotic movies for adults. And yet, of the ones we've covered thus far, Emily, and we have covered a handful of them at this point, I do think that this movie is attempting something deeper, right? Like, it's... And listen, I think we all love Basic Instinct on here for its audacity and for its just, like, fucking craziness. But, like, this movie is actually trying to wrestle with the idea of, like, sex as an emotional outlet of some sort, you know? And that it isn't just... you know, horny for the sake of horny, but then it's also like kind of boring at times too.
I mean, it's interesting because like a British man has only fucked once in his life and he fucks someone hot, you know, three times and is ready to risk it all.
Yeah.
Throw it all away.
Like,
what's fascinating to me about Juliette Binoche in this movie, one of the most gorgeous women to have ever lived, but she is styled like, imagine the like big felt tip marker, like they needed to boost sales and they were like, we're gonna have a sexy marker now.
She looks
that's
like
how she styled
Isabella Rossellini in an SNL sketch, like she
or like Lilith Stern and Crane.
She's styled so severely, especially because she's supposed to be like, they picked the worst of both worlds between styling her like an ingenue and styling her like a femme fatale. She has this weird girly haircut, but like the worst middle-aged clothes.
Yes.
The thing is, like, her clothes are also not, I don't, it's very odd. They're very stiff.
I don't know.
Listen, the thing is, as someone whose idea of what's sexy derives entirely from the people playing secularists in a church camp skit I saw once.
Do be like that.
This movie, the hottest movie I've ever seen. Everybody in it just,
Okay, so
I like how Isabel, I like how Juliette Binoche looks like she's like 30 years older than her fiance, who appears to be like 17.
Yes.
Okay, so with this most like pull back hair, I work in a newspaper. Oh my
I
god, my father.
Love, is this the time to tell you guys that I have a huge crush on young Rupert Graves? I saw, I love him. I saw
Maurice.
Like,
no,
what
do you love
can
him
you believe
from?
That I've never seen?
That's also fucked.
Maurice. It's in. Sane.
Okay.
I saw A Room with a View when I was quite young, and he's in that as Helena Bonham Carter's like younger brother. And I was like, who is this man? He is so sexy. Lo and behold, I look him up. I'm like, I've been watching this man for 3 years, and none other than BBC
there
Sherlock.
It is. I fucking knew it. Got your fucking ass. I didn't got it, but you got yourself.
I got myself.
The Benedict Cumberbatch one?
Mm-hmm.
Can we just do like a sidebar on that? Because that show sucks. That show's bad. Oh. I hate that show.
It's one of the worst, like in it ages like milk.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
That's the thing. When I watched it while it was airing, I was like, this is brilliant. If you haven't rewatched it recently, I encourage you to go back because you're just like, I'm sorry.
Don't say that. He'll do it.
Like there's a couple episodes that are legitimately good. But most of them are like so bad, and the conclusions that he draws are nonsense, and he's a dick to everyone,
man.
And it's not even gay at the end of the day.
The thing about it is You say it aged like milk. And for me, I watched that pilot. I still think it's a really great pilot.
I agree.
And you're like, what a good fucking first episode. And then literally every following episode was a little bit worse than the one that came before.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, there's...
But it's stretched out over so many years, too. I know.
And the hype...
Is, like, the worst part.
The hype was too big, like, in between seasons.
It got swallowed by its own...
Yeah, the only halfway decent episodes are the pilot, the end of season one where Moriarty shows up because he's played by Andrew Scott and he's amazing. And I think the episode at the end of season two when Sherlock
dies,
quote unquote. That one is
that one's fine. Yeah, like I'm being a little bit flip because I do think that like there are some really good episodes scattered throughout there, but it is a show that like. It is a show that became too aware of its own fandom. That's never good.
Yeah.
Every show that happens to ends poorly.
And not a single good female character to be found anywhere.
No.
So Rupert on Sherlock is the cop, right? Like the detective who...
He's Inspector Lestrade, and he's really fun. He just kind of shows up, delivers dialogue, eats a croissant, leaves.
You remember when Sherlock, Irene Adler showed up and she was obsessed with him and her phone said, I am blank, 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 blank locked and no one could figure it out. And he said, I am Sherlocked. And everyone was like, whoa.
And that's what it was. Do you also remember how they made her canonically a lesbian except for Sherlock? And then they were John Watson was like, oh, but I'm straight. And she's like, well, I'm a lesbian. Look at us both. And then they never followed up on that ever again.
I'm canonically a straight woman, except for that hot marker that was in that one.
Hot marker. So the hot marker, the aforementioned hot marker in this film, Julia Pinoche.
Back on topic. Beautifully done.
Do we have
I'm one of the hosts. I had to bring it back.
For the first time ever. favorite Julia Pinoche performance? Do we have
one? Of all time?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, it's obviously Shock a Lot, right? No, I mean, I feel like, I mean, it's Blue, probably. Kieslowski's Blue, which is great. I love her in English Patient. I know that that's, you know, a basic take, but I do really like her. I like that movie and I like her in it. But Emily, do you have a Pinoche?
I get her confused with Julia Ormond all the time. Okay. So I'm just going to make
sure. A lot less that movies than Julia Pinoche.
Yeah, no, I just like they have both have names that start with Julie.
Yes,
that's true.
And
dark hair.
You know, I got to say, I don't know if anybody's seen her film Damage. I think that's the best. No. I fucking love her in... I'm making sure there's not one I like more than this, but I don't think there's going to be. I fucking love her in Clouds of Sils Maria, which is one of my
favorite movies.
I think she's pretty brilliant in that. But she's also amazing in Certified Copy. Like,
I haven't seen that.
She's always good, you know? She was good in this movie, which, you know...
What about her in Godzilla? Did you like her in Godzilla?
Oh, listen, you want to go hard on Godzilla? I got 5 minutes. Like that movie, I love that Godzilla. Movie. I love the 2014 Godzilla. It was in my top 10 that year.
Good movie.
I didn't remember she was in it though, but this that is again is
shocking news.
There you go.
That is like the thing about that movie is it has humans in it, but only incidentally. It has humans in it the way that like, you know, I don't know. I don't have a joke there. I was going to have one.
I think that Julia Pinoche is one of those French actors that has crossed over from time to time into obviously into American films when they wanted to have an international flavor.
Yes.
But ultimately is better in French movies more times than
not. Would you say a chocolat flavor?
Yes. I should have said quoi, if you will. but she's... So this is kind of her first American movie. I mean, I guess Unbearable Lightness of Being comes out a few years previous, which have we seen Unbearable Lightness of Being?
Have
Has anyone
not
seen this film.
Never been that late in my life.
I couldn't tell you much about it, but I do remember seeing it and liking it. It came out on Criterion or something, right?
Years ago. It has not been on remastered on Blu-ray, but it's it's based on the who wrote the book? God damn it. Hold on. Milan
Kundera.
Yes.
Milan Kundera. Yeah.
And it's Daniel Day-Lewis, Philip Kaufman directed it. It's a sexy 80s melodrama that deals with like existentialism and what have you. But
not
I feel like
confused that... with the sexy 90s drama that
correct.
Deals with
correct.
Existentialism.
She does that in 88, she does this in 92, then she does Blue in 93. And then she's in a lot of Miramax movies, which I think should say speak volumes probably in terms of like what the metrics were, I guess. But yeah, I mean, listen, I like
Good
her. She's
life.
So watchable. And she's like fucking stunning in this. This is one of those things where like where you have a scene where she sees Jeremy Irons for the first time and they basically exchange like five words, but you're like, I get it. I mean, I would probably throw it all
other.
Away for Juliette Binoche as well.
Yeah.
But I would also throw it all away for Jeremy Irons.
Oh, interesting.
Let us not discount this tall man's swag.
I agree.
Emily, Jeremy Irons hot?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Good.
I think he's very hot. He has a he carries himself with confidence.
Sure.
And
he's
flair,
a lanky white boy.
And he is a very good dresser.
He is dressed
very
to the
important.
Nines. Though that like that button coat
yes.
kind of mm-hmm. situation he has going on.
A lot of good turtlenecks.
Good.
Man can mm-hmm. wear a turtleneck. I
Man
would not
wears
date
a lot
him.
Of turtlenecks.
I would not date him, but I would definitely have a clandestine affair with him.
I would yes. You know? I think yes. the thing I yeah. think the thing that makes Jeremy Irons worth having an affair with
is
that no matter it, like you could be his wife yeah. and he would make you feel like it was forbidden to have sex with you.
Exactly.
He'd be like, I cannot. And you'd be like, oh, Jeremy, you can't.
He has just enough of that like British like general shame
yes.
going on
yes.
at all times that you're like, yeah, I feel like you need to let it all out.
He also
and boy does he let it all out.
He does for sure. He also has like a little bit of a creep vibe, right? Like he's a
well,
little
I mean, of course. He's a bad guy.
He's because it's interesting because like for me, I mean, I think the first time I saw him was probably Dead Ringers when I was a kid,
mm-hmm. Which he's not as hot in.
Well, no,
I think he has this thing. I was talking about this with my partner where he is like a guy who's like very hot young and hot older. Mm. But that middle period
yep.
is where he's kind of figuring out his vibe. But like the older he gets, the gray, the swoop.
Sure.
I'm like, you know how to style yourself now at an older age.
Yes.
Which is pretty hard for some people of his caliber. You know,
I agree.
His caliber.
I think that, I mean, Reverse of the Fortune is really kind of the moment for him in a lot. He wins the Oscar for it. He plays Klaus von Bülow, the man who notoriously killed his wife. It's an okay
movie. He looks like someone who would kill his wife.
He does look like someone who would kill his wife.
It is forbidden to kill you, my darling. Oh, Jeremy,
oh,
it's fine.
Stop.
I mean, there's a part of me as I was watching this where I was like, could anyone else play this role other than Jeremy Irons? Like, I'm sure that you could have found another
Michael
British
Douglas.
Actor that would have the kind of uppity kind of whatever, but it's that sort of darkness underneath the surface of Jeremy Irons.
My pitch is so insane that I don't think I could say Richard Dreyfuss.
Notorious British actor.
I think it yeah no you what you do is you make it to be about like a congressperson from Connecticut and he's just like, I'm having an affair with my son's fiance.
What is
okay,
this
that's
movie
good. That's
you're
good
pitching.
This is good. I would watch this.
Yeah, it's called Damage. It's about a house. It's about a house representative from Connecticut who has an affair with his son's fiance. It stars Richard Dreyfuss.
This is good.
And the young Winona Ryder.
Mm. And we give it 5 years.
Nope. No,
shit's
thank
going
you.
On.
Hard pass.
This is getting in development.
I would argue
they remade this for Netflix, which is
oh yeah,
they remade it. And it was
Obsession.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Wait. What?
Yes.
I've never seen it. Richard Armitage is in it, which
Are you saying the movie that we watched for this very podcast
they remade?
There is a Netflix miniseries. Yeah,
there's a TV and Netflix 2023 called Obsession.
Richard Armitage is there.
It had a universal negative review.
Might be worth checking out. Yeah, apparently it's god awful, but I do love Richard Armitage.
I would argue that Jeremy Irons' most iconic performance is Scar from The Lion King, but maybe that's just me.
I mean, he's also like, if we're talking like his later life is, I mean, like obviously like he's like so great, but I feel like he's like hit like a gorgeous pocket.
Yes.
Where he is recently. Like, I mean, like, I think he's fun in House of Gucci, dare I say.
He is good in House of Gucci.
Like in Watchmen, he's fucking unbelievable.
And he's not terrible incredible in Watchmen. As Alfred in
Snyder's Batman movie, he's not asked to do too much.
No, but he's good. He's in The Beekeeper, guys. You can see him on the big screen right now.
He also did a audiobook recording of Lolita, which is to me, I'm like, yeah, of course he did.
He's in Lolita.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the thing about this movie is I've seen that Lolita with Jeremy Irons. It's not a very good movie, but he plays being attracted to his son's adult fiance with the same level of like, this is scandalous, this is as being attracted to a 14-year-old girl. It's just like,
I'm gonna leave a little bit of context for our listeners.
Phil,
yes, sure.
Phil,
yes,
before we go there, can I throw a question out to the group? My wife just slacked me this, and I think it's important we discuss it. This is a question from my wife, Libby Hill, once a future guest. Do you think they'll ever reboot Diagnosis Murder?
Yes.
Yeah, they should.
With Richard.
The hell is Diagnosis Murder?
Sorry, yeah. Hold for.
Oh, that's right. You're both so young. Oh my god.
Dick Van Dyke played a doctor, solved murders.
Yeah.
Medical murders. Mary Van Dyke.
I think they need to reboot it simply because I can't believe I've never heard the title Diagnosis Murder before. I mean, that's
it's a great title.
I'm
sorry. It originated from a spinoff from a show called Jake and the Fat Man.
Correct.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You've never heard of Jake and the Fat Man?
Really?
It's a show about this guy named Jake, and he's partners with a fat man. That's the premise. Ooh. He's played by William Conrad, who was a famous, like, larger man who was a TV star
was different
for a long time
in the past. TV, guys.
Yeah. What are we doing here?
Diagnosis Murder will be done for sure.
Oh,
when
okay.
When they reboot Diagnosis Murder, they should cast Richard Dreyfuss.
I'm looking at photos of Diagnosis Murder, and I do think that I know this like iteration of Dick Van Dyke with like the stash. Yeah. And
Murder She Wrote, but he's a doctor.
Is he doing like a really big British accent?
No.
No.
Damn.
He did that exactly one time. And none of us ever let him forget it.
Boy, was it perfect though.
Why is Libby thinking about Diagnosis Murder?
I have no idea. You know how Dick Van Dyke is in Dick Tracy?
Yes.
Yeah, he is.
I think that he had such a good time being that he was like to his agents, find me something that is like that, but also the exact opposite. And that's how he landed in Diagnosis Murder.
How long did Diagnosis Murder run for?
Not long enough.
I think eight seasons. And it's on Pluto TV right now, guys. You could watch it right now for free.
Right now.
I'm asking Libby why she's thinking about this. So Phil, you do that. I'm going to give a little context, but I'm just going to jump in and just say the answer and then let you keep
going. Great. Upper crust British politician Stephen, played by Jeremy Irons, is in a dull but stable marriage with Ingrid, played by Miranda Richardson. When Stephen meets the alluring fiance of his son, Anna, played by Juliette Binoche, he's overcome with passion and starts an intense but dangerous affair with her. That Anna is engaged to his son and says she is haunted by personal demons is not enough to stop Stephen. Continuing the distorted relationship, Stephen struggles to avoid destroying himself and his family. Damage opened on December 23rd, 1992, up against A Few Good Men, Aladdin, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, The Bodyguard, Forever Young, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to...
So Libby was listening to the pod through the wall, and she just thought it would be a funny non sequitur, TBH, literally just sitting out here trying to earn your love. I think she's threatened by how much damage made me a heterosexual.
It would go on to make $31 million. It has 81% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 73% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 out of 4 stars. This review is something, guys. One of the most sublime and hazardous moments in human experience comes when two people lock eyes and realize they are sexually attracted to one another. They may not act on that knowledge. They may file it away for future reference. What future reference might that be, Roger? They may deny it. They may never see each other again. But the moment has happened, and for an instant, all other considerations are insignificant. Damage is not about romance, but about obsession, about erotomania of the part of an older man and complex and hidden feelings on the part of a younger woman. The film is based on the bestseller by Josephine Hart, which had a certain undeniable power, but the right place for this material is on the screen, I think, because it can show exactly how two people can look at one another. Damage, like Last Tango in Paris and The Unbearable Lightness of Being, in one of the rare movies that is about sexuality but not sex, about the tension between people, not quote-unquote relationships, about how physical love is meaningless without a psychic engine behind it. Stephen and Anne are wrong to do what they do in Damage, but they cannot help themselves. They know they are careening toward disaster. We cannot look away.
I really love erotomania.
Yeah.
I feel like we got to bring that back as a word.
Isn't that the name of your autobiography?
Most Jesus. Decidedly not.
Definitely no.
Erotomania.
It's the Phoenix song, right? Yeah.
The thing.
Again, we're too young.
You know that song. It came out in like fucking 2005.
I know that song.
I don't.
Listomania.
It came out in the early 2010s. I know you're not that fucking young, Jordan.
Yeah.
You were alive in the early 2010s.
Let's see, you were like
aware of things. You knew what it meant to eat food and breathe oxygen and how you needed to stay alive. I just like
now your parental instincts are flaring up, Emily.
Made me angry.
It's never a good sign if I know something and Jordan doesn't know it.
So can I just talk about that sort of the elephant in the room, if you will, when it comes to this movie?
The Siskel and Ebert being like, this is one of the most compelling movies ever made, is just like,
they're just horny white
guys. It's not. They're just horny.
And you know
what? I do love that Ebert spends
bring it back.
Three pages waxing poetic about this movie when it's just like, we get it. You thought it was hot.
You've locked eyes with a hot woman before.
That said, if this movie, it's like not to be like the if this movie was released today, but I do think people would kind of lose their minds if you had a movie like half as horny as this, like released in theaters today.
I was thinking about
the last erotic thriller.
Fair Play was sort of one that kind of came to mind. Mm-hmm. First of all, I like Fair Play. But also, Jordan.
Let's do Type 5 on Saltburn.
Do you have two hours?
We need to do a 17-hour podcast on fucking Saltburn.
Jordan, Damage is not an erotic thriller, though. It's a drama with erotic elements. It's not a thriller. There's no plotting.
He trips.
Yeah.
Erotic drama is. Saltburn's not an erotic drama.
But I think that it would.
The reason
that I bring up Saltburn is because it has the same sort of like gasp inducing moments, she said sarcastically, that this movie, I think, clearly from the Siskel and Ebert reviews, like, brought up at the time. I'm just using it as like the current day litmus test, as close as we can get.
To Jordan's point,
yeah,
we don't make these movies anymore, and by that I mean, you know, I actually think if I'm going to draw a corollary, and this is going to sound strange, but bear with me for a second, I actually think that Soderbergh's Solaris is closer to this universe in terms of the like Bertolucci, very sort of internal, like sex as a metaphor stuff.
Yeah. There's
and
passages.
That was 2002. That's a long time
ago. Jordan.
No, yeah, I guess passages, but that's still like.
Sure.
I guess it's queer, so I put it in a different category.
Emily, what's the closest thing to Damage that has come out in the last 10 years?
Right?
Can you think of anything?
Jurassic World Dominion. No,
I was
crazy, that scene.
It was pretty hot.
I mean, you get Sam Neill and Laura Dern alone in a room with a bunch of weird fucking termites, and you're like, whoa. Jesus. I am thinking about this. Like, I do think that Passages is a really good answer. Mm-hmm. I think that that kind of hits that vibe, but it is like a thing that has sort of. What's hard about this is that there are so few movies like Damage. Damage is just a movie about, so it's based on a novel written by a woman, which I haven't read. It seems that all of the plot events from that novel are in this movie. It's a pretty faithful adaptation.
It's a short book too. It's 190 pages.
Love enough.
Watch, and it was like such a hit.
It was.
And it was immediately optioned to be adapted for the screen. And you watch this movie and you're like, oh, this is because, you know, this is what, like, this is a movie about how older guys think about themselves, basically. And I have to imagine the novel has some layer of satire over it. We just kind of don't make movies like this anymore. And when we did make them in the past, generally there had to be an added layer of thriller, comedy, something like that to bring the masses in. So, like, because this is based on a book, it's, like, important in some way. Mm-hmm. But it just, you know, a movie I think is kind of close to it that isn't close in our period, but like, is the Michael Crichton adaptation Disclosure.
Yes.
And that movie had to add a whole bunch of fucking weird VR stuff to be like,
that movie's crazy.
Do you think like a Shame is kind of like in the same world?
The thing about Damage is that it's about like how sex, it's about how sex is like, it'll ruin your life, but that's a good thing in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, your whole life gets destroyed and you lose everything. But when you're having it, it's the best. And Shame is kind of about how sex will ruin your life. But that's a sad thing.
Right. Like, Notes on a Scandal, because it's kind of like has that like a little bit bigger, you know, something a little like scandalous.
That movie's,
I'm just trying to think down because movie, like,
but I know what you're saying.
I mean, I would agree because that movie's cuckoo bananas. But I guess like watching this, it made me like pang for something similar to it. And I think it was like, on one hand, seeing adults in like heightened situations similar to this, or on the other hand is like genuinely just like seeing sex on screen, even if it is like weird sex. I think like we don't kind of have this anymore.
I think all of the examples I'm coming up with are queer, because that is an accepted subgenre of queer cinema.
For sure.
Like I just saw All of Us Strangers, and I think that's an example of a movie that kind of plays in this same space, even though it's got a lot of other things going on. And Andrew Hyde's earlier film Weekend also plays in this space. It's just like straightforward, erotic, romantic drama that deals with some of these consequences. But like, you know, in queer movies, the conflict tends to come from outside. It tends to be like the world is forcing us apart, mm-hmm. or whatever. And in this movie, it's like, I can't stop thinking with my dick, but God, it's great. Like, and that's the conflict. What this is this guy against himself.
Little Children.
That's not a bad one.
That's probably like that's the like, closest.
Yeah.
I want to throw, did you guys see the remake of Lady Chatterley's Lover? The Netflix movie with Emma Corrin?
I did. I liked it,
but it's also like,
I would liked it more.
I do too, mm-hmm. but it was the reason I'm bringing it up is very explicit. I mean, like it was a movie that just like really went there. And similar to this film, I think that movie was all about, finding a sexual freedom, finding your sort of your voice, finding who you are as a person through your lover and all that kind of stuff, which I think is really well done in that movie. But again, mm-hmm. like it's a Netflix movie, so it basically doesn't exist. So
I'm such an easy mark though for mm-hmm. like any streaming movie that's like, this is a really like explicitly sexual movie. I'm like,
sign me
play.
Up.
Thank you. Because I'm not because I'm a horny weirdo, although that is true. But I'm
both things can be true.
No
both things can be true. I'm very interested in kind of like the evolution of how sex is being portrayed on screen. And to Emily's point, the sort of delineation between like queer filmmakers making films about queer sex, which seems to actually, like, because of how indie it can be and how it kind of, like, exists in its own little bubble, and things that are more like, this is supposed to be, like, a relatively accessible erotic film.
You know what? You know what movie is exactly like this in almost every particular? Carol. Carol is almost, is everything about Carol is like this movie, except it's about lesbians. Like, that's seen through a certain lens, Carol is a movie about a sexual predator.
Yeah.
And I don't read it through that lens, but, like, you can.
Yeah.
And this movie, you can read through that lens. They're both about, like, that movie has a happier ending, but it also gives you plenty of space to be like, oh, Carol fucks things up for people she loves all the time. Everyone, she'll probably fuck things up for Therese as well. So that's my answer, is Carol.
That's a good answer.
I'm glad it took us 15 minutes. But I got there.
I do have a question on, like, this kind of discussion on, like, sex, though, on screen. Because
Harold,
I think
they're lesbians. That's the answer.
That's true.
Harold, they're lesbians.
Because I guess, you know, we have a lot of readers in this room, and I think it's, like, fascinating, because I was reading an article yesterday about, like, the rise of kind of, like, these smutty novels, and, like, obviously smutty novels have existed forever, but I think, like, there's
they've gone mainstream,
subset of, like, TikTok, and they have hit this mainstream, which I think is interesting, because, like, in, you know, this erotic, you know, 90s, 80s, etc., there was, like, this boom of these kind of thrillers, and for some reason these, like, erotic smutty books have kind of, like, exploded mainstream recently. Like, I don't know if there's a correlation between the two, but it's fascinating how, like, these books have boomed while movies like this aren't being made anymore, and I read, that flip-flop there, you know?
I read a lot of romance, and in the romance space, it is now it's now considered pretty standard to have, like serious sex scenes. Even someone like Emily Henry, who tends to write books that are not particularly sex filled, has to have, like, one scene every book that's like, now we're going to see how they have sex, and it's going to be hot. And a lot of her books have been optioned or getting turned into movies, so I'm interested to see how that gets handled. But, like, someone like Tessa Bailey, her books are, like, wall-to-wall sex, and it's just, like, that is now considered almost a prerequisite to have a book get that big. And I think it's cool, but I do think it's this, like, weird thing of, like, sex is, like, this fundamental thing in our culture that we increasingly can't talk about outside of, like, niche subgenres.
I also think it's worth noting, too, that, you know, 50 Shades was probably the last time that we had, you know, something of that, something that zeitgeisty, a huge book, and the movies were quite successful. I remember at the time there was kind of this, the industry was kind of like, should this just be an HBO or a Showtime show? You know, should this be the type of thing that, like, are people going to go to the theater to watch?
Are we all going to go see tits together?
Right. Like, are we all going to, like, sit in a dark room together and I'll watch, you know, balls put inside women? Like, is that metal balls? Like, is that what we're going to do? And apparently, yes, and then no, because it starts really strong and then the series kind of peters off in terms of its box office results. But I bring this up just to say, I agree with you, Emily, and I wonder if, you know, the E.L. James of it all has had sort of a longer tail in terms of its effect on the literary scene.
Here's what's wild is that I think that people are much more comfortable right now with smut in books because it's like, it's private, even though, you know, you're putting your entire face and voice on TikTok to talk about how, like, you know, hot and bothered this book made you. But it's like between you and the page. And a lot, I, you know, God forbid I bring up the weird puritanical sex discourse, but a lot of people are like, it feels non-consensual for me to have to, like, watch characters have sex. And Emily, to your point about romance books, like, I like how it's yes, it's a staple sometimes to a fault, but also it's like the smut doesn't take away from the romance. And looking at seeing something like Red, White, and Royal Blue get adapted and, like, all the explicit stuff just get, like, it's technically in there, but it's not in there in the same way. It's just kind of, like, sweeping romantic and they're having sex, but it's, you know, it's not at all like it is in the book. I'm just using that because that's, like, I think I'm really interested to see how stuff like Emily Henry and Tessa Bailey and Colleen Hoover, gets, like, turned into these adaptations, because it's like, how how explicit is it going to be? That's like the driving factor.
I didn't love Red, White, and Royal Blue, the book.
Yeah. Oh.
But I didn't like the movie. I haven't seen the movie, so I can't give it up. I didn't think the book was very good. But I do think an interesting thing about the romance genre and how it melts with sex, and a thing that films kind of never figured out, because films have traditionally had the cis white straight male gaze and have been pinned down by that.
Yeah.
But my favorite romance author is Alexandria Belflore, who's a queer female writer, but she writes both WLW and MLW pairings, basically. She writes exclusively about bisexuals, and even when she writes about bisexuals who are having relationships, heterosexual relationships, they both take a moment where they're like, but I'm bisexual and you need to know that. And the other one's like, I am also bisexual. That makes this a queer novel.
Reading the bisexual
community makes a difference. Wait, can you what's the name of that
book? Alexandria Belflore. Uh-huh. And like thing that I love about her best books, and not every one of her books is a winner, but like her best books, is the sex scenes are character building. They are scenes that are about these two people learning to learning what each other needs, what each other wants, psychologically necessary to their development. And I think that kind of sex has rarely been on camera. Totally. I think when we think about watching a sex scene, even when you think about watching a sex scene in a movie like Oppenheimer, which is using it for a very specific purpose and in a very specific way, everybody just sort of interprets that through the lens of porn, because that's like the only way we know how to think about it. And a movie like this is in conversation, like, and trying to one up a movie like Last Tango in Paris, which is just like, all they can think about is how can we make this look as sexy as possible? But their idea of sexy extends entirely to visual and has nothing to do with like the spiritual, the personal, in a weird way.
So I think it's interesting because I didn't read the book. So I've not read the book Damage. So I can't speak to that. But I do think that one of my biggest issues with this film is that I don't actually buy the central relationship. It happens far too quickly for me. And I think that there's a lot of stuff on the page that I'm sure they could have done a great job of really kind of making me buy into what these two people are so drawn to. Whereas on the screen, it seems unfortunately superficial. As good as the performances are from Jeremy and Juliet, it just kind of feels like, I don't think they say five sentences to each other before they decide that they're going to fuck. And it was a hurdle for me.
I think there's something, I totally hear you and I agree. The only like disagreement I have is purely from a cinematic, like, I guess, like, brain, where I think like there is something innately hot about like just like making eye contact with someone and being like, you want to fuck, I want to fuck, and kind of like going into it.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think like after that first encounter, you really start to feel the why of the relationship, especially like when you get the certain reveals about like her character, and it kind of becomes like very questionable about like why she's engaging in these relationships, you know, and everything about him kind of just feels like he's so deeply sexually repressed in his life, or like hasn't necessarily like had something feel exciting like that before.
That's so interesting, because I feel like I kind of read it, and I would say that I read it like against authorial intent, as like a cautionary tale. Like, don't stray from your loving marriage and start thinking with your dick, or you will end up with an incest obsessed woman in her 20s who ruins your life.
Like, the ending definitely feels like it's like,
No, but also you'll remember it for the rest of your life, and you'll have a giant photo of her on your wall and
while
Trump's.
You eat cheese in some
while you eat cheese
undetermined European country.
But I think that I liked the take of this being like, this is bad, we're just watching a man make worse and worse decisions, and there's nothing we can do about it because we're the audience and we just have to sit here.
Ebert said that in his review, actually. He was like, it is like watching a car crash in slow motion, right? Like, you do find yourself watching it just being like, this is all bad. But I guess my issue ultimately comes down to Anna's character just felt not great. Like, didn't feel well written, didn't feel like fully formed. And Juliet's doing the best she can. But I also feel like there's a real lack of emotion. Like, she seems like dead-eyed most of the time. And you're just like, are you just a monster? Or
it's
like,
just
what
about
is
the
this?
Sex? It seemed the honestly the most confounding part of the movie for me is I was like, why is she still with Martin? Like, I don't understand what she sees in him. Like, I feel like Juliet and Jeremy are just in it for the taboo sex of it all.
But the mom
it's
calls
hot,
her
it's
out
addictive.
And says she's with him because he looks like her brother.
Yeah.
And you're just like, cool.
Nice.
I mean, like, the movie is kind of firmly planted in, like, I think if we're reading it as Jeremy making worse and worse decisions, I do kind of like the fact that we're in his POV for most of the movie, if not all. So he's kind of like looking at Juliet like this manic pixie sex girl.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like
this inscrutable, enigmatic,
right, he's like,
French
this
woman.
Mysterious woman who saved my life. Right. And like not actually like picking up on everything like happening around him.
He's a psycho.
Or like anything, yeah, like he just like can't read any situation. Like, I do think that adds, like, sure. I don't know if it would be better if we got moments with Juliet, because I do, like, I'm sure maybe it would be, but I think there is something to like firmly plant you in kind of like this freak's POV for the whole movie, you know.
Well, making her a cipher I think is interesting, but yeah. Emily, sorry.
Yeah,
again, I haven't read the book, but again it seems like a very faithful adaptation. And usually when a woman writer is writing a book about a guy like this who does this sort of thing, she's doing so with a great intentionality, and she's exploring. I think Lolita is written by a man, but Lolita is written by a guy who was a survivor of child sexual abuse. He didn't like define himself as such, but like he wrote about his uncle treating him badly. Okay. And that book is, of course, if you like read it, is like a text that is about an abusive relationship, but then got read and interpreted by Hollywood as a great romance and has been portrayed as a great romance over and over. And I wonder if something similar has happened here, not in the sense that, like, I think Josephine Hart wrote like a serious like morality play or anything, but I'm guessing that like she's playing around with this idea of like, why do these guys throw away their lives on much younger women? And then the movie gets into the hands of these filmmakers and they're like, a guy's going to throw his life away on a much younger, like there's the thing about this movie is the plot of the movie and the sex scenes of the movie are working entirely at cross purposes. Yes. And we're not even getting to the fact that the sex scenes in this movie are fucking bonkers. Like,
crazy.
We'll get into that in a second.
Crazy.
But like, just like the fact that like the sex, they had to cut a bunch out of this to get an R rating. And you watch the sex scenes and you're like, okay, I guess, but how? And it's just like, so the sex scenes are trying to be the most erotic thing ever. And I think it's trying to underline why this guy is so obsessed with her, but we don't need to know why he's so obsessed with her, because the point is that his obsession is boring. It's typical. Right. It's prosaic.
Yes.
And like the movie almost gets there. And then it'll be like, here's Jeremy Irons nibbling on Juliet Binoche's back like it's an empty corn cob.
You know, I'd be lying if I said that I am well versed in Louis Malle's work. I've seen a couple of his films.
You had dinner.
I've seen My Dinner with Andre, which is probably his
most
famous movie. Is that like
dinner,
is that his most
pulled up a chair?
I have pulled up a chair and I have sat at the table with Andre and whoever the other guy is.
Wallace Shawn.
Okay. I've seen his Vanya on 42nd Street. With Julianne Moore, which is interesting. It's fine. I've seen Atlantic City. I think I saw that. The who's in it? Is it Lancaster? Yeah, Burt Lancaster and Susan Sarandon. And I've never seen Pretty Baby, which is sort of the notorious Brooke Shields film.
Pretty Baby, another movie in this vein. Mm-hmm. Though it's very much like he's making a movie about like a serious thing, but he kind of can't stop thinking as a horny dude. And it's just like, my man, maybe not this time. Just maybe not this time. Au revoir, Les Enfants is quite good. Mm-hmm. I would check that one out.
Yeah.
Atlantic City and My Dinner with Andre, I think, are his best. I did, like, weirdly, I saw Vanya on 42nd Street as like a 14-year-old. I was like, I gotta fucking see this thing. And I did love it. I haven't seen it since, but
I mean, I think that the sex scenes in this movie are pretty fucking gonzo. I mean, there's one in particular for our listeners. There's a scene where it's very Last Tango in Paris, where she's sort of sitting on his lap. They're both naked and they're covering each other's eyes. And she's just flailing her arms about, like, I don't know, like a xenomorph or something. Like, I'm just like, I don't even know what's happening. It doesn't seem enjoyable particularly. Like, the sex scenes in this movie are quite restrained for the most part, especially like Jeremy is basically just giving the bare minimum of sort of any kind of emotional what have you. And Juliet,
well, he also
just,
is like a five thrust kind of guy in this movie. Yeah. Most of it is just them kind of like aggressively kissing, like
shoving their
parts of each other's bodies, and then
head against the floor. I'm just like, you're gonna hurt yourself. Like, just relax.
I mean, he does have the, not to be like lewd or whatever, but the first time that he finishes, he does give out that insane yell where he's just like, or whatever, which is just like, that's when I knew. I was like, what are we in for right now?
What is going on?
It's also like, there's the scene that I think it's the second time they have. It should also be said that from a production perspective, and this is something that they used to do back in the day, there was no blocking and there was no rehearsal. They just kind of let the actors do whatever they wanted to do, which led to, there was this in an interview Juliette Binoche gave in 2004, she said that Jeremy Irons acted his French kiss a little too realistically in one of their love scenes and she bit him. Like, to basically be like, fuck off,
stop that.
That sex scene that starts with their hands over each other's eyes and then they do like full body like splits, like they look like they're the marionettes from Being John Malkovich, just kind of fucking flopping around. It's great.
The Parisian street scene kind of goes hard though, where that they're just like, we gotta fuck right now. We're fucking on the street. Like,
I just tell you, that was that the first scene hottest. They shot. The first scene they shot in the entire film was that scene.
That rocks.
Maybe that makes sense why it's the hottest. They were like getting to know each other, because I also think that's the one that captures the like intense sexual need the best. The one that sticks in my brain the most is when they come back from the party that they're at
and she's crawling on the floor and he
they like almost have sex on top of a gas stove, which is obviously a huge danger and fire hazard. But that was the other one that I was like, I understand the specific like erotic emotions that they're going for. I like that Juliette Binoche is just kind of like, here I am, let's go. She clearly is very into it, but she's kind of lets
she puts her arms go out all in over this, her like, Christ-like pose.
Yeah,
and like, just kind of like lets herself be some like Raggedy Ann doll. It's very strange.
I mean, there's the whole like, if we're like, just because we're going, I guess we're doing a check mark through them all. Like, even like, I do think the like house one is kind of fascinating if you want to read into the like the risque of it all, because it kind of starts out accidental, but then in like everything like involving the window, there's that element of like quote unquote danger, and especially like doing it with both spouses in the house and the like, oh, I need to be with you right now. We have to go to your bedroom. You know, like, it's, I see it.
So it should be said that originally Isabelle Adjani, I believe is how you say her name, who was in Unbearable Lightness of Being, was originally cast as Anna, but couldn't do it for scheduling conflicts. And then, in a twist of fate, Jodie Foster was offered the lead role.
I love Jodie Foster so much. She's so wrong for this.
Yeah, and she said that. She said in the end, the character didn't feel right for her. But like, I don't know what the Jeremy Irons, Jodie Foster movie looks like, but it is very different.
Not this.
I don't.
That's because they would have had to recast Jeremy Irons with Richard Dreyfuss. And this is just the powerful eroticism of Dreyfuss and Foster.
Can you imagine? Like, yeah, anyway. Yeah, so it obviously ends up being Juliette Binoche. I can't really imagine it being anybody else. Like the attention that she demands silently just by like entering a frame. Yeah. Kind of the only way it works.
This is certainly yeah. the type. I also think she crucially has to be foreign in some way. Thing, yeah. She can't be English.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it deals with like the English repression and like.
Yes. You know, I think it has to have this sort of European like exoticism to her. Yeah. A la Chocolat.
Totally.
Of course.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Jordan.
Just because we're thinking about like the macro theme, like I guess this got me thinking. Like you asked the question of like why is she with Martin, right? And it's like, you know, I guess that brings to like the whole crux of like what the movie's pitch is. But like, I do think there would be something fascinating about like examining a father who is so deeply jealous of his son, or like nervous about his son kind of getting everything that he wished that he had or could have done the things that he wanted to do. Like there's very small moments where you can kind of see that. Like when I forget who's, maybe it's his dad, his wife's dad.
Jeremy Irons' father-in-law.
Where he's like, this kid's really done it all. Yeah. He's got the goods. Like, isn't he the greatest? And like, you can kind of read on Irons that like jealousy a bit, which I think is fascinating. Cause I think there's something interesting about like a parent being jealous of a child.
Yes.
But this movie's like decidedly not at all examining that, but there is that like,
oh, for sure.
Quiet through line throughout the whole movie. If you want to like look
well,
at
there's
it
the scene where
like
he
that.
Tells him about his promotion as well, where yeah. you get the sense that Jeremy Irons is like, how did you do it so young? You know what I mean? Like there's this, right. No, that is a really interesting reading and that he is fucking Anna in some weird revenge, like yeah. puffing himself up sort of way. Yeah.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Totally.
And yeah. also I think this idea of like living vicariously through his son in more ways than yeah. one, that he's jealous, but he's also proud and he wants to like, yeah, I think recapture his youth, but also experience the success that his son is experiencing. Yeah, Jordan's making a face
saying,
that
like,
is
the
accurate.
Success that his son is experiencing is yeah. just like,
well, I guess I also just feel like the Miranda Richardson of it all, Miranda Richardson does not give off a vibe of a, like, she doesn't seem like a repressed British woman.
No, she's just like a normal British woman.
Awesome.
I,
like, what are you
that's
doing?
That's why I really agree with Emily's read that there's a level of, there's likely a level of satire to the novel that's not yeah. quite on screen, because you're like, this is a perfectly happy marriage that he's fucking up for no reason other than he wants to. That's why I think initially was drawn to like, oh, this movie kind of reminded me of Passages, because you're like, there's nothing wrong. This man is not lacking anything. Mm-hmm. He is simply like, all of his issues are with himself.
Yeah. Sure. I do like that read. That's good. That's a good call. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a lot of, it does feel a little bit to kind of go back to what we were saying about Anna being this kind of enigma cipher thing. There's that moment when like he grabs her head and like screams, who are you? Who are you? Which isn't subtle, but I do think it's effective for what it's worth.
Yeah, again, that's why the Anna Martin relationship is like right. the weirdest thing to me, because I'm like, I don't yeah. understand what he sees in her. He, except for overlooking the fact that his fiance is possibly insane, like seems like yeah. a very put together, nice uh-huh. young man.
I think there's that one line where it's like, I forget who said it, but it's like Martin like understands her for who she is and like is like working on like helping her or something like that, where you're like, does he like, he knows like she's sleeping around with other people, but like I don't think that's the yeah. answer, because then the reveal at the end where he doesn't know, granted it's his father, so that would be a like a more visceral reaction, but still, you know,
I think
it'd be so Martin. Much more interesting from the perspective of Martin and Julia Binoche.
Yeah.
It is like, and if they have kind of a quasi open relationship, but also it's 1992. He's the son of a like politician.
Yeah. yeah.
It's like, this is very scandalous. It needs to be kept under wraps. And like I think there's something interesting in stories about people trying to live unrepressed lifestyles in repressive societies. Mm. And like, yeah, this the second this movie loses any satirical element or any sort of distance, it doesn't have enough distance from Jeremy Irons' character.
Yeah.
Like that, the character, you are sitting there and you're supposed to watch and be like, yeah, that woman's hot. I would have sex with her. And she's hot, you know, but like it doesn't, it only considers the consequences in the last half hour. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of liked the last half hour, mm-hmm. even as the rest of the movie's like, just, you know, weird puppets flailing away at each other.
I do think that Anna's...
You know what movie this is? It's like The Great Muppet Caper.
Well, now that you bring that up, I think that's a good...
Emily, do you have any idea what you've done? Do you
Let's do this.
Emily...
What you've done.
I'm not going to allow this to be derailed into a Muppets conversation.
What's your favorite Muppet movie?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Yes.
I am putting my
foot down.
Ben
Kingsley and Sexy Beast. Yes.
I want to talk for a second about...
Muppet movie.
The Muppets?
No. I want to talk about Anna's choice and taste in men.
Kermit the Frog, Fozzie
Martin,
Bear.
She's got, oh, now the fucking thumb thing came out. She's got Martin, she's got Jeremy Irons, and she's got Peter Stormare.
Yeah. Murderer hero.
A murderer.
Peter Stormare, goated with the sauce.
Also, wait, before we, I just have to call this out really quickly. Yeah. David Thewlis appears for 30 seconds in this movie.
Love it.
As a cop. I was like, excuse me, he's a detective at the very end. And I was like, is that fucking David Thewlis?
Holy
and it
shit.
Was the same
that's
when
cool.
Peter Stormare showed up. I was like, excuse me, what
both
is
these guys only
here?
Have one scene. Stormare only has one scene,
but Stormare bodies his scene.
He does. Yes, Emily,
no, go ahead, Brooke, you were gonna say something.
I was gonna say, so she's attracted to men who look like her deceased brother. None of these men look even remotely alike. Just gonna
Stormare,
put that out there.
Is Stormare hot?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes I feel like when I'm on a show with Brooke, I just agree every man is hot because I'm like, yes.
But the thing is, like, I have a very particular type.
Uh-huh.
My type,
big, muscular.
Mm-hmm.
But your type is also Martin and Peter Stormare.
No, Brooke's type's not Martin.
She just said that she has a thing for Rupert.
Well,
but I have it because he's a cutie patootie. Like he's
because he's a cutie patootie is not a reason.
I don't like what
a
fuck
I think that's
him.
A reason.
I
that's,
wanna,
a,
like,
that's a valid reason.
Hold his hand in a park.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay.
That's romantic. That's
I'm
romantic.
Tussle his hair.
My type is widowed single dad. That's my type.
So Jeremy Irons.
I just am. Well, I mean, he whatever. But I do. Actually, I have kind of a serious question for you, Phil.
Yeah.
Or all of us, honestly, but I'm going to direct it to Phil because I know Phil the best. So we do, like, we have talked a lot about, like, casting this movie and recasting the roles that maybe should have been played differently. And I'm wondering if this movie could keep one human actor and everyone else was a Muppet.
I
who would
you
pick
right now?
Emily, I love you
I am
so
not
much.
Letting this go into the Muppets.
Muppets?
Okay.
Marionettes?
You gotta stick with
no,
Jeremy
obviously,
Irons.
Obviously, Miss Piggy is Juliette Binoche.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Now, I am reticent to bring X-rated Muppets into the world.
Have you seen
Avenue
Q?
That's the thing. It would still be rated G.
Happy Time Murders.
No, this is not a sexy movie. This is just a fun comedy, you know, about a guy who gets involved with a pig.
You know how every Muppet movie is like a riff on a genre? That's the Muppets riff on erotic thrillers.
I'm watching this.
I will say, I want to defend my Peter Stormare comment. I think that most people that are in movies have some sort of magnetic quality that I will agree is hot. I also feel bad being like, well, that person's not hot. But I get the Peter Stormare.
What is the hottest Peter Stormare performance for you?
Ooh, I don't know if I am versed in enough Stormare to give a proper answer to that question. But let me do my.
Did you say Prison Break?
Prison Break.
I mean, Prison Break would be
Prison
up
Break
there.
Though.
Jurassic Park.
I mean, it might be. Oh my God, why can't it? Constantine.
Fargo. Oh, he's good in Constantine.
Let's see here.
I don't know if he's hot though. Brooke, I know what you're saying though. Like, there are certain people that have this innate.
He just has like a magnetism. I think Stormare is one of those people. Jeremy Irons is also one of those people. Like, they're very compelling. They're very magnetic.
He's in Chocolat.
There's a hot element to that. He is in Chocolat. Yeah. What were you going to say, Jordan?
Sorry, Jordan.
Well, I was just thinking of like charismatic, magnetic characters, and like Kermit the Frog is like for sure.
Oh
like
my
one
God.
Of the most charismatic.
I regret throwing the mic back to you.
I'm so sorry. Any Muppets we can get, I'm like,
Jordan,
I gotta
never apologize. Never apologize. This is your show too. You're on that. When you're on the show, it's your show.
Well, look, Emily, this is just a platform for me to try to convince Brooke to watch the Muppet movies.
I'm working
so if
on
I
it.
Have any other outlet, I can just pull. You know,
I'm working.
They're
working
good, Brooke.
On it.
Watch them. That's the end of the Muppets for this episode. Okay.
Oh, that's what you think.
I mean, I mean, I think that. Peter Stormare has such a presence.
Yes.
And he seems like a murderer. Like he radiates like, I'm going to hurt someone.
Yes.
I don't know how.
Fargo.
Or 8mm or like any of the movies that most.
I like A Little
in.
Danger.
Okay.
A little sprinkle. Of murderous intent.
Okay.
Who the hell is he in? Oh right, he's the bad guy in 22 Jump Street. I was looking at the 22 Jump Street. I was like, literally, who is he in that? He's the dad.
Yeah, he's very briefly in American Gods, playing like
he's
an old god of war.
He's
and
in Dancer
like,
in the Dark. He's in Minority Report.
He's in
like,
so many.
Big Lebowski.
I think he's hot in the way an abscessed tooth is hot. He's just kind
of
like,
I don't know what to make.
Like
about.
There's just a quality of like. Inability to look away from him, I think.
The way that Jeremy Irons is drawn to Juliette Binoche is the way that I am drawn to men who possibly could kill somebody.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good.
You're like, I don't know what it is, but it's something.
I do feel like there's a moment in this film when Jeremy Irons is in the hotel or the building next to Martin and Anna, and he sees them like making out in the window or whatever. And then he like gets into the fetal position and starts to cry on the bed. And I'm just like, dude, get your shit together.
Like, what's this clearly happening? Is a deeper problem. I could not believe. I think the moment where my opinion like on this film changed for the better was when he left his conference in Brussels and was like, take me to the airport to go to Paris. I was like, whoa, that's insane.
I'm ready to risk it all.
That's crazy.
I'm gonna
that you
risk
would do
it
that.
All.
Yeah. And
my guy, he is your son.
Yeah. Who you like.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's the thing, is like, maybe it would be more interesting if like he and the son had such like maybe like a fraught relationship.
No, I think it's more interesting.
Or is
that,
it better if he's not? Yeah.
Yeah, because that would be too easy. I think
it's, he's like, haha, fuck my son.
It's designed to be kind of inscrutable, like in the way that Anna is a cipher. I think that like Fleming is also supposed to be a cipher, and that there's no good reason for him to make these decisions other than he's like thinking with his dick, which is also like, I think that Miranda Richardson's sort of takedown of him is not meant to be read as like objective truth. That's her being like, this is how I am choosing to like process this, is that like you couldn't do anything except think with your dick because like you don't think that I'm attractive anymore because I'm a woman of the same age as you.
Sure.
Like, but I think it's like Fleming's reasons are much thornier than that.
I think
I've been thinking a lot about about the adaptation choices. I think there are a lot of books written by any gender of author that are have women in them who have some form of sexual compulsion. And generally, the books do a really great job of delving into the psychology of this woman was abused in some capacity. This woman is a survivor of sexual assault, et cetera, et cetera. And they're like digging into the many ways that in a patriarchal society, women might choose to deal with that to like sort of blunt their pain.
Sure.
And then inevitably when they get adapted to film, again, they just get filtered through this gaze that's like, well, sometimes women just want to fuck you and that's great. And like this movie's trying to do more than that, but it keeps coming back to that. Mm-hmm. And it just can't, yeah, it can't escape the gravitational pull of that.
It's also such an easy out for it to be like, guys, all along she just wanted to fuck her brother. Don't read too deeply into it. She's got some problems.
In a movie, it just gets written off as she's crazy.
Yeah.
And like, in a book, even in a book where the point of view person thinks this woman's crazy, you can do more with her interiority
for sure
than on film, where you're really reliant on the performance of the actor, but also the director and like the point of view of the director. And like Juliette Binoche obviously could have played the world's most interior driven woman, but this movie just wants her to be a good looking marker.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's
And this is why I think like smutty books are overwhelmingly I have a point, I promise. At this time are overwhelmingly written by women, and they're designed with a kind of like interiority for the female characters and the love interests that's rarely afforded to like the same kind of stories on film or on TV.
I think like if all things are being equal, I'm probably more attracted to more men than to women. I'm attracted to everybody, to be clear. If you've listened to this podcast, you're aware that I think every human being on the planet is attractive. And I'm like, wonderful. But I tend to prefer reading queer romance het romance, because so often queer romance has to deal with that problem.
Yeah.
Like, we have to overcome our psychological blocks to be together, and we're going to do that by having great sex. But I think like Emily Henry is my favorite writer of het romance right now, because she's very much into these two people are broken,
right.
And maybe they can help each other, maybe they can heal each other. And like, you don't see that in movie romances anymore. I do think it's one of the reasons the rom-com has fallen on such hard times, because like, you fucking watch When Harry Met Sally or Sleepless in Seattle or whatever, those are people who have like really bad things in their lives that they need to like overcome and to be together. And we just don't, you know, you watch like Glenn Powell and Sidney Sweeney are very attractive people, but that movie doesn't really want to go there.
No.
What
are the problems in their life?
They don't have
They're too hot.
They're too hot, Jordan.
It's so hard being a blonde, hot person.
Yeah. It's also, I think the men in the When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle era of like great, great rom-coms. And I think that this applies to like really any genre of romance film. Like the men are real characters as much as the women are real characters. Like you have to have a balance of both. You cannot, and that's, I think, one of the problems, as we've been talking about with Damage, is that it's like, you can't have a male character who's just kind of like a thinly drawn female fantasy, or a female character is a thinly drawn male fantasy, and expect us as the audience to like really buy their love story.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing with all romances is that they inherently need to be about both the act of looking and the act of being seen. And too many movies forget about anything other than looking.
Right.
Like this movie is about Jeremy Irons looking at Juliette Binoche. It is not about how it feels for her to be seen by him, even if she likes that the way being seen. But like,
and of course, erotic dramas are made for men and rom-coms are made for women. And so we don't need to worry about the fact that there's going to be all kinds of people watching both genres.
But I also feel like this
gender binaries do exist for sure.
Yeah.
I would be very interested to see this film directed by a woman.
Me too.
Taking sort of the male gaze out of it, because I think
it didn't feel male gaze
to me, but I still would have liked exactly what you're talking about, Emily, that Anna's character had just more three-dimensionality to her.
It's really more of a writing problem.
Well, that's
I think Louis Malle has an appreciation for these characters in a way that like a lot of directors would have just horned it up.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I think he, you know, inherently there is a certain thing where like he just can't get past this is a story about a crazy lady who seduces a man and destroys his life. And it's just like, okay, sure.
I mean, she doesn't just destroy his life. I mean, there is, we should sort of unpack a little bit of this brother stuff for a second here. Because like she has this brother who, when he was 16, he was, it seemed as though he was in love with her and possessive of her. And then he kills himself. And then she, with his blood on her, runs into the arms of Peter Stormare and essentially demands that he have sex with her at 15, with the blood of her brother all over her. It's just a lot of like, and I would also say too that I tend to like, this all feels, and forgive me, but this all feels very literary. If I had read that in a book, I think that there's just something different about reading it as opposed to it being told to you in a monologue. It just feels, it's just hard to execute stuff like that for me. It just feels like a hurdle. And I feel like so much of Anna's character is off screen shit that she has to kind of tell us about and backfill through other means or her mom. Like it all just, it's very expo.
Yeah.
And basically once that story is revealed, you don't need to know anything else about her. The movie is like, okay, like,
which is fucked up. This character that's the skeleton key to her character is like this one terrible trauma that happened.
Right.
Which, by the way, like, I mean, okay, but I just feel as though there could have just been more to her. Yeah,
she has fucked up sexual like inclinations because she had a semi incestuous like relationship with her brother and was traumatized by his death. Okay.
There's like a way to also then explore both like the mom and like the, I think there's like something interesting, not necessarily in the movie, but like how blunt and upfront the mom is about it, almost like where she's like hanging like a lamp over Julia Binoche's head about this thing where she's like, oh, look, you're fucking another one of your brothers. And like this,
no
like,
sympathy for her at all.
Totally. Like it's kind of fascinating. And then again, like Brooke, what you were talking about earlier, where, the movie's like, I guess, like macro message on like, don't fucking cheat on your wife.
Naughty.
It's also then like, don't be obsessed. Like, don't think that you own women, you know, but like, it doesn't, I don't know if it fully like catalyzes, like crystallizes, that idea.
There is a thing that happens a lot in families where there is incestuous sexual abuse that is like the girl involved in it is inevitably blamed for it, even if she was not the instigator of it in a lot of these situations. And you send them that horribly damages because the people who are supposed to be protecting her are not protecting her. And you can see the seeds of that here. And the movie doesn't really do anything with it. It's just sort of like, her mom doesn't like her very much. Oh, well.
Right. Yep.
Like,
isn't that terrible? There's a lot that more to happened, unpack there. And now she's fucked up as a result of it. Anyway.
Yeah. The mom,
moving on.
As much as I,
is this kind of like hurricane that enters the film a little bit in terms of the bluntness and in terms of sort of trying to navigate what she is seeing transpiring just based on eye contact or lack thereof at a dinner table. And it is interesting, but you know,
as much as I like, don't think I need any more of this story. Sure. And as much as I looked at the 4-episode running time of the 2023 version, I do think there's a version of this that is like a 6-episode limited series from the POVs of the various characters that basically recounts some of the same events, but like gives you more depth, gives you more history to some of the characters. Like this is a story, again, I think that this story could work beautifully on the page, but the camera literalizes in a way that a lot of books can't escape. You have to be very, very, very smart and very particular in adaptation choices to take a book that is about this subject matter and not just make it the flattest version of it. And it feels like that just didn't happen here.
I agree. I mean, I like what you were saying, Emily, in terms of, I mean, one of the things I liked about what I would say is a flawed show, but I liked The Affair, at least the first season that I watched of it, because of that idea of a POV of an affair and different perspectives, how the different people involved in this affair are viewing it. And I think that there's a way to do that with this too.
I remember when that show came out, I was so into it. And then one of the knocks against it was the two people had extremely different memories of the same event. Like, basically, they remembered it completely differently. And a lot of critics were like, how would this ever happen? Sure. And that felt like the last moment when you could do that. And then, like, because we've just been living with the ramifications of, like, people remember things differently. And sometimes that leads to disastrous results ever since. But you should watch all of The Affair, because the final season, part of it's set in the future, which has been ravaged by climate change.
Stop
and, like,
it.
That's no, seriously. That's like, and like, Anna Paquin plays the daughter of one of the couples,
oh,
and she's like,
God,
going out to a Long Island that's half underwater because of climate,
wow,
change, and she's like trying to research her parents.
I do think that show,
that kind of rocks. That's pretty,
it's
cool.
Pretty amazing.
It's pretty fucking, yeah,
wild. Like,
cool.
Season,
that's,
you can
wild,
tell, like, they want to go weird, like they want to go take,
yeah,
big swings, and that feels like they did.
Oh, like,
what,
is it, is a show, it is a show that I can't really in good conscience recommend, sure, but like, it would, like Ruth Wilson, yeah, would like come to hate the creator, and the creator would be like, we're working that into the fucking show. And it would just, like, it would go hard. I had so much respect for it, and I never, like, entirely liked it. I was just always like, this is going weird places.
Yeah.
Good
five
for
whole
it.
Seasons.
Yeah.
That's,
it went for a while.
Goodness.
I mean, that's the thing about Showtime when it was Showtime.
Listen,
yes, Emily,
Showtime should let all shows run.
Emily has no problems with Showtime.
Not at all.
Perfect network, nothing bad to say.
They've never made any mistakes, and they don't have any shows right now that should probably have hard end dates, but which I'm like, if you get like one more season out of that, I don't know, could be fun.
I love that. I mean, I it is so funny to me that, you know, Showtime, prior to it becoming Paramount Plus on Showtime, whatever the fuck it is, or with Showtime or whatever, was like, its big thing was like, we are going to drain every fucking episode we can out of this thing.
Oh yeah. I like, so I used to be semi-involved in Yellow Jackets fan spaces,
sure,
and
yeah,
I'm not anymore for obvious,
sure,
reasons, but like, I would read people just be like, well, it's on Showtime, they're gonna make it run for
forever,
9 seasons, and that's a terrible idea. And I would always be like, I don't think they will, because this is a show that absolutely, like, needs to have an ending point. It can't just run forever. It's like Lost, blah blah blah. But yeah, and I don't think they will, because I think Showtime really has turned over a new leaf. But also, if Showtime was like, Yellow Jackets, we just picked you up for 11 more seasons, I don't think anybody would be surprised.
It's like, I think that, I mean, I just genuinely don't know what Showtime is anymore under this new, yeah, regime. So I don't want to speak, you know,
it's like a dwarf planet.
Right.
It is. It is.
It's orbiting.
It's Pluto.
Well, my
the
whole
larger,
thing. And,
well, it's orbiting the Paramount Mountain.
Sure.
Yes.
It's climbing one of the stars.
On.
But
yes.
I said this to, I had lunch with Ashley last week, or maybe it was earlier this week. Couldn't really tell you. And I said to her, I'm willing to bet that in less than 10 years, Showtime is its own thing again. Because this idea that there's a brand there. And as much as Showtime might not have made a ton of television shows that I watched personally, it clearly was doing a thing, and it was doing it relatively well. It had carved out a lane for itself. And I think the idea that they can somehow smush that into Paramount Plus is bad and stupid.
But I mean, like, I think that's the... No, no, go for it.
Like, the thing about being like, oh, they're going to let your show run 11 seasons and like, you'll be so sick of it after conservatively five. That is a brand. Like, it's not a great brand, but like, that people like, that's more of a brand than like, I don't know, fucking FX has. And FX is great. FX makes great television.
Sure.
But like, when you say, what's an FX show, you don't really know in the way that you know what a Showtime 100%. Show is, which is so weird, because
sure,
like, like, your idea of a Showtime show is it ran five seasons
long.
It
is funny because, like, you saying that that Damage had a four-episode... I mean, what is a four-episode... I mean, that's kind of nothing. I can't even really think of anything that had four episodes. And it is the type of thing where, like, if someone had told me that FX had decided to do Damage as a TV show, I'd be like, okay. Like, that's in the sense that, like, FX can kind of do anything that they want. They're kind of brainless in that way. But this is all just a way of saying that Netflix version of Damage, aka Obsessed, just existing in some weird liminal space on Netflix, just to me is a prime example of why, like, it all feels so intangible right now. Just things that exist on Netflix, things that exist on any of these channels that you're just like, nothing breaks through anymore.
And it feels like you can't hold on to a brand of a network or a streamer long enough to actually understand what they want or what you should be turning to them to
Over so much.
I want to
be 100% clear to the president of Showtime, who is absolutely listening to this right now, who's gotten this even the podcast. I love working for you, sir or madam.
Whoever you might be.
I think that Showtime is a perfect network. And when I said that you have a brand, that was a positive.
You do.
You do have a brand. I think that is a good thing. I am so glad.
Of all the episodes for the president of Paramount to listen to, I think Damage is probably the top of the list.
Hey, I mean, you're such a Muppet fan, so.
Listen.
Damn you.
Obsession on Netflix, trying to scope out the competition of this random show that premiered last year, less than a year ago, starring a guy who I like. Who is kind of hot and also has a little bit of murdery inclination. So he's checking my boxes. Okay. And I had no idea.
I'm going to look up the head of Showtime.
Okay. I want to bring us back.
I was going to bring us back too, but yes, please.
I have a question or not even a question, but like,
it's better be a
can
real
we
question.
Talk about the final, not even a question. I just want to talk about it. Can we talk about like the final 10 minutes or so?
I do.
Fucking because, crazy.
Well, before we do that, I want to talk about what preempts the first 10 minutes.
Okay.
Leading into the last 10 minutes, which is Martin discovering.
Yes.
So by sheer chance, it seems there's like a phone call about the flat at the house and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he goes to, and of course they leave the keys in the door. Like there's all these things that
the just, key in the door is like
a bridge too far as I'm concerned, but that's whatever. He opens the door, which, you know, of course it opens right into the bedroom, front door, right into the bedroom. And he sees Jeremy Irons and Julia Binoche having sex, and he's horrified and he kind of stammers back and he kind of trips and falls over the banister.
Terribly shot.
No offense. Yes, no.
Horrible fall. Like one of the worst shot falls I've seen in recent memory.
So he does an endo right over the railing.
Yes.
And falls 4 or 5 flights, it seems, something to that effect.
Yeah.
Dies. Bottom of the stairs.
Immediately.
Dead. Jeremy Irons proceeds.
Yes.
To get out of bed fully nude.
Yes.
And run down 5 flights of stairs.
Dick out.
More power to his dick out. I mean, sure.
Very pro.
The thing that stands out to me and the reason what took me out of this scene isn't the dick out. It's the construction workers that are all just kind of
the guys. The fact that there are bystanders that are like, sure.
There is a aerial bird's eye view shot of like 6 construction workers standing there while a new Jeremy Irons cradles his dead son's body. You're just like, we don't need extras in this.
I could not get over it. Like, I understand the thought process and I kind of am like, oh, this is the first time that, you know, you really see like really any type of explicit nudity besides maybe a quick boob flash. Ooh, like there's really not that much actual nudity in this movie. I was like, I get it in theory, however it's ridiculous. I could not take it seriously, which kind of upset me because I was like, Jeremy Irons is doing the thing.
Yeah, he's doing the thing as
and he's giving Ariana him the performance.
Ariana DeBose. Do you think that if he didn't run nude, that he wouldn't have got like what? Like, does anything change if he runs nude versus he doesn't run nude?
What's the principle of the thing? The idea that like he is ultimately so devastated that his son has been killed that he doesn't stop because Juliette Binoche comes down after him like wrapped in a rope.
It just goes peace.
Well, she leaves. Yeah, she leaves. Literally, like bye.
And I can understand being like, I don't know. The idea is that he is actually devastated. He can't stop for anything.
Right. No, I love that. I guess I was just wondering, like, if the construction workers are there, like, if he's clothed, do you think they think, like, oh, my God, this accident, I wonder who this man is, versus like a nude man just ran down and is cradling a dead body, which feels a little bit more insane.
I mean, it's all crazy, just to be clear.
It's all crazy. The fact that the two of them look up and like lock eyes with Rupert Graves and are just like, Martin, as he stumbles backwards, I'm like, you guys.
Yeah.
Say something, anything.
So Jeremy Irons.
It's not what it looks like.
It kind of is, though.
Jeremy Irons has been interviewed since and has said that he thinks that his nudity, quote unquote, takes away from the scene.
It does.
He thinks it's distracting and that the power of the scene isn't felt because his dong is flying around. And I mean, I get it. But I also think, like, let's just say, for instance, he grabbed his undies and he's running down the stairs in just his undies. I don't think it's ultimately going to be any less distracting.
No,
I disagree. I think that it's not that he's nude and that is distracting. It's the combination of the fact that he's nude and there are extras.
If it was an empty stairwell,
it would be fine. And you'd be like, oh, it's great. It's the fact that he's running past people. Sorry, Emily.
I agree.
They should have done a full Battleship Potemkin where, like, he's running past, like, baby carriages and his, like, dick is flopping around.
You just see his dick pendulum just, like,
swinging. I do think I kind of disagree with him. I think the moment, like, I don't know if the moment works, but I do think that, like, it would not be as powerful if he had shrugged on a bathrobe. There's something so raw about him just needing to be there and not taking the time, and like in a better calibrated movie, I think it really would have landed.
I agree.
Here's a moment that does land for me. Juliette Binoche walking away from this.
Yeah.
Just like that is my favorite shot in the film. And I was like, is this movie secretly a masterpiece? Because from that one shot of her just walking down the street, I was like, oh, this gives me the weight.
Yes.
Everything else has been missing. And then it kind of goes away again. But then Miranda Richardson pops up. Again, I think the last 20 minutes of this movie are pretty good. And if I were going to make a further point, it's that it seems like Showtime has a really exciting executive suite right now. And I'm so glad to be working with them.
This episode is sponsored by Showtime.
Showtime.
I listen.
Use code podcast like it's 1992.
Listen, I just want to say I think Showtime has many fine programs beyond the one that I run, including The Curse, which is a series with Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone. If you haven't watched The Curse, check it out now. You can use my promo code podcast92 at curse.com.
I do think that I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I do think I don't know why this apartment needs to be under construction. I don't know what that actually does. It's like a secret
apartment.
Sure, I don't get the point.
But it ultimately felt like busy stuff. They just kind of like wanted stuff happening in the hallway or whatever. I would argue that that is probably the more detrimental thing than seeing Jeremy Irons.
You remember how this movie, Kate, was out at the same time as Home Alone 2?
It was.
What a fucking double feature. Both about apartment buildings under construction where people fall over railings to doom.
It's true. Except this guy does not get back up like Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern would have.
Do we think the Wet Bandits are a couple?
Yes.
Yes. We did a whole episode about this.
Really?
Yeah, they're gay.
Yeah, we did. We did it for Christmas. It was the worst decision ever because it was two hours of us being like, maybe moving on.
They are, Brooke. They are.
I mean, they certainly have a married couple energy.
Yeah, duh. Have they explored each other's bodies? Yes.
I say yes.
You know the now infamous New York Times op-ed about if Taylor Swift's gay or not,
which
is actually about so many other things, but people read it as like, are they saying Taylor Swift's gay? They should have made that about the Wet Bandits and everyone would have been fine with it.
Yes.
Everyone would have been like, yep,
yes,
sure.
This is bringing up a lot of important points.
Yeah.
I sent it to both of you and I was like, I can't believe that this exists, basically.
It is insane. It's Tree Payne, who is usually pretty damn good at her job, was like, this would never have happened to a man. And I was like, girl, have you ever been on the internet? It has happened to many men.
The New York Times wrote a very similar thing about Harry Styles. Yeah. Harry, known man, Styles.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
So Jordan,
Miranda Richardson, though.
I want, yes. So let's talk about the,
she should play. She, you know what? I think Miranda Richardson would have been a great Tree Pain, like that.
Yeah.
I can see, I see the vision. I see the vision.
People all the time are like, Jessica Chastain, Tree Pain biopic when? And I can see it happening. When's the last time we had a powerful publicist biopic? Possibly never.
That's
maybe never.
Well, if you were talking about Miranda Richardson, Rita Skeeter, of course, you know, that was a powerful fucking journalist doing her work.
You know who else would be really good at playing Tree Pain?
Yeah.
T-Pain?
Miss Piggy.
I thought you were going to say Richard Dreyfuss.
Miss Piggy.
Emily from downtown for three.
Okay, so the end of this film, Janice. Jeremy Irons comes home to Miranda Richardson, all beaten up, blood all over her sweatshirt or whatever she's wearing. And he says, what happened to you? And she said, I felt so awful. I beat the shit out of myself, basically, just to feel some other pain. She then says, why didn't you kill yourself when this began?
Good for her. I would have said the exact same thing. Completely valid question. Of like how,
and she literally is like, how did you think this was going to go? Like, what did you think this was going? And he basically doesn't really have an answer.
No.
Nor should he, I guess, really.
Not at all.
I thought that scene was great. And then it teeters for me a little bit when she gets all kind of, give me my son back, and he says, give me his death, give me his pain. It all just feels a little bit too rote to me. But when they're just fucking like up front and kind of awesomely cold to one another, I was like, this is pretty rad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And then when she goes into the next day too, that scene,
yes,
when she just takes off her top, she's like, what, this isn't enough for you? Like,
Miranda. That's the scene that solid I feel like is like subjective, is like her trying to make sense of things. Is when she's like, this wasn't enough for you. The scene that I think like really gets to, is cathartic and gets to like the heart of what probably everyone in the audience is thinking, is the, why didn't you kill yourself when it started? Like that line, I was like, that I think it's very needed for the movie. It's not enough that his son died. Like, we need someone to look him in the eye and be like, what the fuck?
She also,
brother, what is wrong?
Just to be clear,
you?
She goes even farther and says, like, I would have buried you. I would have wept. You're not an evil man. It would have been okay had you just offed yourself.
Because the idea is that he's like, he's just gonna go on. She's like, you're just gonna go on living, and he's like,
I guess so. I guess I'm gonna make a mural to this one photo in my apartment in Italy
and eat cheese.
I do want to say that, like, the central relationship in this film is horribly, horribly fucked. Like, I think it's not a great idea to sleep with your son's fiance. I just want to come out against that. That's the official position of podcasts, like it's 1990.
It's
don't sleep with
you.
Your son's fiance. But I think monogamy is like, I think monogamy, and I'm a monogamous person, I think it breaks people's brains. I think people get a little like, I think people are a little too weird about cheating. I think people are a little too weird about all this shit. And I do feel like we need to be like a little bit more, I don't know. I think a movie like this comes along and is like, just that histrionic over the topness of it is just so, you know, if Juliette Binoche had just been some random woman to him, like, the movie still probably would have played roughly the same. And I think that's kind of weird. Anyway,
the
official position of podcasts like it's 1992 is people need to chill out about monogamy already.
Right. And subscribe to Paramount with Showtime.
Yes. to watch their lots of great programming, like Your Honor, starring Bryan Cranston as a judge.
He is a judge.
I think that show ended.
It's done.
But you could still watch it.
You can.
It's another season. Wasn't there like two seasons?
There was two seasons.
Yeah.
Two great seasons of television.
Or honestly, Twin Peaks, The Return, one of the greatest things ever made for the television medium, and the kind of thing that only Showtime would produce.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I agree. Mm-hmm.
Genuinely. Yes. And I mean that's great. With deep sincerity.
Couldn't agree with you more. Like, when it's a brilliant thing, which we will talk about, Emily, when we record our episode on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. So to wrap this up, let's rate this movie, and then we're going to talk about what we're covering next week. A movie that I don't know if Jordan and Brooke have seen, or quite frankly, I don't know if Emily's seen it, but I'm just curious. It's just, we'll talk about that. Okay. So I came into this podcast. I didn't really know how I felt about this movie. I was sort of at like I was in the high 50s. I was at like a 59-60. That's and I think that talking about it some more, I'm gonna get to like 62. I'm gonna say that like I have issues with this movie, but it's got some great performances. It's got some great scenes in it. It's cuckoo bananas. Don't fuck your son's fiance. Just don't.
That
do
is
it.
The official that's position the of the podcast. Yes.
So that's where I'm at. Where are Blister you? Where are you,
hot
Jordan?
Take.
What's yours?
Oh gosh, to me.
Yes.
Goodness me. Mm-hmm. I think my immediate first reaction when it ended, I had watched it on an airplane, which is the.
That's fucking crazy. I won't even watch Girls at the Gym for fear that there's good. You watched this on an airplane with strangers?
People around you saw that like crazy sex. Amazing, Jordan.
Yeah. Love it. So my immediate reaction was I literally like the movie ended as we were landing. So I was like that with 5-star banger, no notes. And then immediately like I started thinking about it. And I was like, no, Jordan, what are we doing here? I think my brain was just very excited at the, I hadn't seen an erotic thriller probably in like a year. So it was like watching something somewhat like that. I was like, oh, cool. It has the juice. And I kind of like liked some of the things that it was doing. That said, like, I do think there are a lot of flaws with the movie. And I think that there's a lot, as we've discussed, like there are ways that in which it could have improved or, you know, if like we want to approach it in a different way, I'm going to land a little higher. I'll go like, I was going to say 69, but that's too high
do
for
it.
Me.
You
do
stole
it.
My
well,
bit.
69. Ah, got your ass.
You did.
So Brooke, you're also at 69, I take it.
I was very genuinely going to give it a 69 out of 100 because I do think it's floating in that range for me. And I was like, it's too good not to resist, even though there is a, you know, an unfortunate lack of cunnilingus in this film.
There's an unfortunate lack of oral sex, period.
Yes, of oral sex, period. Yeah.
We're just so in sync today.
I know. And our matching Taylor Swift
sweatshirts.
Unplanned. Okay. Yes. Similar to Jordan, I finished this film on a little bit of a high. I was like, whoa, that was really interesting. And then I was like, this was critically acclaimed. Damn. And then as we unpacked it. So I think I will land at a 66.
Oh, no.
Okay.
I'll let you have your moment.
No, I want you to be with me. You can take 69. I'll go to 66.
All right, Emily.
I just want to be clear about one thing. When I say that Miss Piggy should play you, Tree Pain, I mean that as a high compliment. Miss Piggy's a wonderful dramatic actress.
She's a legend. She's an icon.
You. She would play you perfectly. I'm talking merely about her strengths as an actor. It's not meant to besmirch you personally. You emailed me that one time and I was so happy. And then I got fired and I lost your email address.
Oh, no.
But Tree Pain, please email me back. We'll talk some more. I'm going to give this movie a 50.
50? Really? Right on the...
Right down the middle. The thing is, the last time you two were on the show, we talked single white female, and I gave that movie a 69 as like a thing where I was like, you know what? This seems like it's going to be ironic, but I kind of mean it sincerely.
Yeah.
This movie, I was fascinated by it. It was like studying something like under a microscope and being like, God, there's a lot of weird little things that are a single cell. Mm-hmm. And just being like, there's a little guy that looks like he's got teeth. But he doesn't. He's just got like weird little hairs. And it's just like, that's what I thought about watching this movie. I thought about protozoas. I thought about protozoas and amoebas and algae. Oh, and eventually I came around and was like, this movie's okay. But then the movie ended. And then it was like, he's got a giant painting. So yeah, I'm going to go with a 50 queer phobia scale. There's no real overt queer phobia in this, but I think I have to give it a 7 because this movie would be so much better if they were all gay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Brooke, would this land on the queer quadrant?
A non-existent, doesn't even make the queer quadrant. Not in like it's homophobic. Like, there's just, I don't think like, there's...
Not gay?
Yeah.
I don't want to see the 1992 version of this movie because I think they would have done a terrible job with it. But this movie... about a father who falls in love with his son's fiance, who's a man. Actually, there's like a Michael Cunningham book about this that's really pretty good. Okay. And I'm just like, that is there. There's something there that could be interesting. That's why Showtime should let me make it.
So next week, Damages on Podcast Like It's 1992, we will be covering Sally Potter's film Orlando.
Let's fucking go!
Jordan loves that movie. I haven't seen it.
That's like a queer fucking non-binary masterpiece. Are you kidding me?
Yep.
How would I we not know that movie, Phil?
Dude, you've never seen Wonder Boys or even knew it existed. So like, how? I don't know. You can get as close to the camera as you want right now, Jordan.
Did Wonder Boys have like
Virginia Woolf?
Some huge like cultural impact that I don't know about. I don't know.
It did not. Phil just thinks it's great because
I'm not saying
I'm it's sure a great,
it's
it
a great movie. It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
It was nominated for really, an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Like, it's not like it doesn't exist. It doesn't matter. Wonder Boys
I do really love Wonder Boys. And but like, I do think its cultural impact ended up being sort of muted because it was not a very big hit.
I agree with you. 100%.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So
next week, Lola Prince Kelly coming on to talk about Orlando. Have you seen Orlando, Emily?
I have not.
Okay.
It was one of those movies that I was like enticed by the concept of for some reason. And then I just was like, I better not see that because it might unlock some doors. And I've never circled back. So I'm going to circle back and I'm going to have a good
time.
I'm
super excited to unlock some doors. Because I have seen it once many, many years ago. It's a fascinating movie. It's this. I don't really know how to explain it. Like, I guess a genderless character named Orlando, played by Tilda Swinton.
Binary character, perchance.
played by the only person who could play this role, basically.
Yeah.
Tilda Swinton. Yeah. And sort of over several hundred years, they are kind of transported, kind of ish between. Anyway, it starts in the 1600s and 1700s, Constantinople. I think you're going to like it, Emily.
I'm going to love it.
Emily, yeah. It was like a movie I watched after the like unlock thing. And then it was sort of a thing that was like, oh, this cemented a thing, you know, where you're like, oh, okay. Like I get it. Like everything makes sense now.
Genuinely though, like when I was reading about this movie back when it came out, I was like, oh, so they get to live 100 years as a woman and then they have to live 100 years as a man. Who would want to do that? And like, I should have gotten somewhere just from Roger Ebert's review of this film. Like,
but I it should be said that Sarah Pauly did a really big introduction. They showed it in 35 at TIFF at the Lightbox in Toronto. She did this whole long introduction. It's one of her favorite films. And then when I asked her to come on the podcast, I was like, do you want to come on for Orlando? She's like, no, I'd rather come on for a different movie, of which our listeners will find out later.
You can call her a friend of the pod.
She is a friend of the pod. I'm very excited that she's going to be coming back to talk about the exact opposite of Orlando, as far as I can tell.
Who is coming to talk Orlando with you? Can you reveal?
Yes. No, yeah. Lola Prince Kelly, who is a friend. They are an actor. They came on for one of Emily's favorite films of 1992 thus far, Poison Ivy.
A fucking rule, Poison fucking Ivy, so good. Still like here's the thing, I have several films ranked above it on my top 10 list of the year, but I just like when people are like, what should I watch, like Poison Ivy and Deep Cover, those are the two where I'm like, oh, just
deep
big
cover.
Discoveries
deep cover, good.
Yeah. Those were I had not seen either of those films, only one of which spawned three direct to video sequels, unfortunately.
Yeah. It was Cool World.
No. But Brooke, you should watch her.
Yes, I fucking will. Oh my god,
it rips.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it is just, if you look up the poster, have you seen the poster?
Oh yeah,
it? Her in the with her hair and this it's good shit.
Yeah.
Good shit.
Yeah.
Tilda,
oh no,
ageless.
I fully need to watch this. I did not realize it was so queer.
Yeah.
Like hottest, twinkiest Tilda.
Yeah.
It's
I got
it. Is it
this.
Not Billy Zane? Is he not?
Yeah. Yes, it's Billy Zane.
Also, Tope Stevens is in it. I don't know how much he's in it, but I love him.
I mean, you're going to get some Billy Zane, Emily. You're going to be
Billy Zane rides in on a horse with a wig unlike anything you've ever seen. It's incredible.
It looks so cool.
Can we just talk about something right now?
If it's about the fucking Muppets, I swear to God.
No, it's about how it's about how Rose DeWitt Bucator should have given Billy Zane another chance.
Now,
why?
Now, girl.
Listen,
it's a hot take.
As you said, I think Men Who Might Murder Me in a fictional context are kind of hot.
Oh, no.
And you know he might. You know he might murder me.
I think he actually kind of tries.
Rose, you know what? Rose should just go and be with Jack, that little frozen fucker, because I'm going to date Billy Zane. Cal.
So, Billy Zane's character, Cal, in Titanic.
Like Titanic. I refer to the film Titanic.
Perfect movie.
Perfect.
Yeah, it is a pretty perfect movie, but
except it should have ended with me like making him feel better about losing everything.
Yes,
sure, of course.
But Cal, is Cal that bad? Is really kind of
yeah.
He abuses his partner.
He's a bad person.
Okay. He sucks.
But I could fix him.
He's not like fun murdery. He's
no, he's just like rancid vibes.
Basically, the thing about him is that he's kind of written to be fun murdery, and Billy Zane's like, no, I'm going to go all in, James. And that's James Cameron's like, do it.
Okay.
So like in my brain, I'm thinking of his scenes, and I'm like, what a fun guy. And then I watch that movie, and I'm like, he needs to go to the bottom of the fucking ocean. And fortunately, he's on the Titanic, so it might happen.
Do you think
you keep watching, you're like, maybe it will happen this time.
So he lost the Best Villain MTV Movie Award in 1997.
Mm-hmm. That must have been the only award Titanic lost.
Who was the villain that beat him?
Oh, wait, hold on. I think I'm in the wrong year. Yeah, I'm in the wrong year. Hold on a second. I will. Hold on.
Bill.
I'm sorry.
Well, while you look that up, I just want to point out that.
Hold on. I'll tell you who it is right now. Best Villain went to Mike Myers. In Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
Great win. Great win. Deserved.
The other nominees were Nicolas Cage and John Travolta for Face Off. Gary Oldman also for Air Force One, Al Pacino for The Devil's Advocate, and Billy Zane for Titanic.
I think
that's a great
I
lineup.
Think Pacino should have won. I'm going to be real with you.
This is like how, you know, Titanic lost supporting actress to Kim Basinger. And you're like, yeah, but you know that's kind of deserved. You say Mike Myers, and I'm like, yeah, that makes sense to me. It's it's good. I just looked up Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel's top 10 list from 1992. They both had Damage on there. Siskel had it. Yeah, Siskel had it seventh. The movie it's one spot ahead of, to just bring this all full circle, Wayne's World. Mm-hmm. He had Wayne's World at number eight.
That's a great
one.
I love that. And his number 10 was Under Siege. So
what is this list?
Man of the People, Gene Siskel.
Good list.
What's number one on Gene's list?
It was, here, I have it right here. Number one was, his number one was One False Move. Roger's number one was Malcolm X. And Roger had Damage at sixth. So they both had Damage in kind of the same range.
And the other is a cool number one pick, for the record.
What's actually really cool is that this isn't cool at all, because nobody's going to fucking care about this, but Gene Siskel had Damage at seven, and something I've never heard of called The Hairdresser's Husband at six.
Ooh.
And Roger had The Hairdresser's Husband at seven and Damage at six. They just did a flop.
Do they both have Howard's End?
They both had Howard's End at third.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Like,
is Unforgiven on either of their lists?
Roger has Unforgiven. Gene Siskel fucking hated Unforgiven.
Why did he hate it so much?
Bad take.
We talked about it in our Unforgiven episode.
But why did he hate it so
much? He basically just like, he just couldn't get on its wavelength. Okay. Ebert also couldn't, but he went back and revisited it and was like, I like this better now. And then he put it number nine on his list. Weird. So
I mean, it's a good movie.
I mean, Wayne's World and Under Siege. God bless Gene Siskel. I mean, seriously, pour one out for Gene Siskel. Guys, you're the best. Best in the
biz. Best.
Where can people hear you? Where can people listen to you? Tell the people.
We co-host The Queer Quadrant. We talk about queer content in blockbuster movies. You can hear us anywhere you're listening to this. Spotify, Apple, we're everywhere. We just had a maestro moment most recently with Fran Hoffner. And if you want to hear our takes on like the queer films of 2023. We have that episode recently out as well. It is a good and chaotic time. We love you. Check us out.
We love you guys.
Slam dunk.
You guys are the best.
Listen.
Yes, Emily.
Can I just, if you are going to do a 3-hour Saltburn episode, can I be
on?
Oh my
God. Please have
it. Why not? Yeah.
Well,
do it.
Just do a Saltburn miniseries.
I guess we're just going to do it. Brooke, what if we did a Saltburn week? We bring on a guest each day of the week.
Everyone has thoughts. We need a round table. Emily, we'll hit you up.
I do feel like I missed out by not getting one of the bathtubs at the Alamo Draft House.
Yeah, you missed out by having a good life.
Wow. I think we should all buy the candle.
No.
The bathwater candle.
I'm getting staunchly opposed to this.
You know what I'm actually legit pissed that I didn't do? Is that when Cats was there, I went to see a rowdy screening of Cats, and the drinks
came
in
little
cat dishes that you would drink the drinks in, and I didn't get one. And I'm just so
I wonder if we were at the same screening. Brooke and I went together.
We
did
go together.
Did you have someone yell at the back of the audience when... And this is one of my favorite movie experience moments. Ian McKellen... is drinking from his cat dish, and someone at the back of the theater yelled, "What a fucking pro!"
I don't think so, but that
I
rocks.
Don't think so because we had someone in the Mistopheles and Victoria like romance scene. Sure. Someone in the back yelled, "That is gay," and it was so funny.
I mean,
I think about it all
it's
the
not
time.
Wrong.
No notes.
I saw that movie several times. I did see a rowdy screening of it at Alamo with my wife and a friend of mine, both of whom took edibles. And like halfway through one of the numbers, I looked over and my wife was just going, no. And anyway, she doesn't like Cats.
I went to see it with past and future guests, Ashley Lyle and Allison Akel. And
I mean, perfect people to see it with.
And I vividly remember the lights go down, and like the first shot is like this eerie street. Yes. And Ashley turns to me, she's like, "Why am I scared?"
I saw Cats.
Good movie.
At the first public screening of it, not public, the first critic screening in LA. Flanked by my friends Lindsay Ellis, the great video essayist, and Angie Hahn, the great critic.
Yes.
And
we
just had such a great time.
Yeah.
And then at the end, when Judi Dench turns to camera and says, "A cat is not a dog," Angie just fucking lost it. Like she had no familiarity with Cats. Lindsay and I both knew it backwards and forwards because we're cursed Broadway children.
As am I.
But Angie Hahn was just like, "What is this?" And she just like fucking lost her mind. And I was like, I forgot that was in there. Like,
isn't
that how it ends? Yeah. Isn't that like the last line?
Yes.
Yeah. You have to be preconditioned from an early age to understand Cats. I feel like you understand Cats the most when you're like 12. And then as you grow older, you lose your understanding. It's like Neverland. You know, you can never get it back.
Crazy thing.
I make sure to play the Cats soundtrack every night over my child's crib.
Yeah.
I'm just like, we're going to get you there, baby.
They'll grow up to be cultured.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Rum Tum Tugger, it's a pretty curious cat.
We did do an episode on Cats. If people are interested in more Cats talk.
Did you have a guest or was it just you guys?
God, no.
We did have a guest.
Oh, we Wyatt. Actually did. We had a full guest. But to be fair, our guest already knew us in real life. Wyatt Muma, he's a friend of ours.
Friend of the pod.
IRL friend of the pod pre-us podcasting, because God forbid anyone has to deal with our takes firsthand.
Just to give our listeners a taste of the future with Jordan and Brooke individually on our Patreon.
Mm.
Jordan is coming back on our Patreon to talk about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And Inside Llewyn Davis. We're going to talk about some Coen musicals.
Yeah.
Kind of musicals, right? They're musicals. Are they musicals, Emily?
Sure.
Movies with extensive diegetic music.
You could do a convincing stage musical of both.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
If you want it.
Absolutely.
And then Brooke is coming back with TBD guests. To talk about Evermore versus Folklore.
You just mean me. Every time Brooke comes on to talk about Taylor Swift,
you go
like,
witchy
Emily.
About it. So, you know, that was, I'm keeping it TBD.
Maybe, I will be there. Maybe regardless of who there. Joins me.
Maybe she
Wait,
won't.
It's Evermore versus what?
Folklore.
Oh.
It's time.
Brooke, it's time.
Brooke, where do
I'm
you,
thinking
where do you
about,
land
I'm thinking
again?
About.
So you'll have to listen and
you have
find
to listen
out.
To the episode. Yes, Emily?
I'm thinking about coming on just to be like, I'm kind of over Taylor Swift.
Stop it.
Like, I'm thinking about it.
Here's the thing.
Emily, you better save that take for
midsummer.
I'm gonna save it for your show.
Here's what I love is when Emily did this on one other Patreon episode where she just helicoptered in, dropped a bunch of hot takes, and then left.
And then helicoptered out.
That's
I can see that. Believe me, I will come in prepared with 3 hours of solo notes. Phil, you can just turn on your mute and I'll
just sit here.
I'll just go.
Oh, Vamp. That'll be great. Yeah. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Either Let's way, it. You're going to get more Brooke. You're going to get more Jordan.
I'm so sorry.
And
you're definitely getting more Emily.
Oh, you're getting more Emily, whether you like it or not. That's happening.
Can I say one more thing about Cats?
Yes.
Please.
As long as it's not about the Muppets.
It's nothing to do with the Muppets. Oh. Cats should not be besmirched by Muppets.
There you go.
What? A cat is not a Muppet.
I don't think the two things mixed. Angie went on to love Cats so much. I think she's seen it 9 or 10 times.
Wow.
Good.
And she, when she found out that Libby was pregnant, she was like, you need to make sure that your child thinks the only movie that exists is Cats until they like go to school. And now I'm like, should I do
that's
that?
It's a lot of commitment, but
that's really good though. That's really good.
It would be worth it.
Is it, here's one last question for the group. Is it Hooper's best film?
No, but it's close. It's close. Damned United and King's Speech are both probably better, but like it's definitely better than,
Danish Girl?
I probably would put Les Mis above it, but Girl's a disaster.
I do like Les Mis. I'm sorry.
I've got a soft spot for Les Mis.
Really?
But what I'm saying here is I would like recommend Cats. I think Cats is a blast. Yes. I think it's fun to watch that movie. I don't think Hooper intended it to be watched on the level I appreciate it, but like it's a movie where Judi Dench says a cat is not a dog, and there's a dancing railroad cat. And my most popular tweet,
Shanks, put some love on his name.
Yeah.
My most popular tweet of all time for a while was me quoting the resurrection story from the Bible, but just replacing Jesus with Skimbleshanks, and people loved it.
That sounds like a good bit. That's a good bit.
That's really good.
I can't believe we ended up talking about Cats.
We talked about everything in this episode, guys, and that's why it was great. And if you're still listening, we love you.
I'm sorry.
And if you're still listening, you're from Showtime. I like my job. Thank you.
Good night, guys. Bye.
Good night. Podcast Nuggets. Podcast Nuggets. 1992.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.